Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen, and thank you to the Australian Business Economist for once again giving me the opportunity to speak to you this morning. Last Friday, we released our regular statement on monetary policy. There's a lot in there, not all of which I can cover today. Instead, I'd like to take the opportunity to talk a bit more about some selected themes in that document. In particular, I'd like to talk about some of the questions we grapple with as we consider the outlook for the domestic economy. Before I do, let me briefly summarise our current thinking on the global and domestic economies. The global economy has been picking up since mid-2016 and seems to have improved further over the course of 2017. As we came into the new year, we and other forecasters continued to upgrade our future views of the outlook for the global economy. In Australia, our forecasts for growth are essentially unchanged from the ones we published in November. We still expect growth to pick up to around 3.25% over 2018 and 2019. While our forecasts for wage growth and inflation are also unchanged, there are some positive signs that make us a bit more confident that the expected pickup in wage growth and inflation will eventuate. Business conditions are looking more positive, employment growth has been rapid, and short-term indicators of future hiring have picked up further. We are still a bit further behind some other advanced economies in working down the spare capacity in the economy. So it might take a bit longer for the turnaround in inflation to happen here than elsewhere. But there has been progress on this front, and we expect more progress will be made over the next few years. The current expansionary stance of monetary policy has been helpful in that regard. This progress is, however, expected to be quite gradual. In considering this more positive outlook, forecasters nonetheless must grapple with a range of uncertainties. We talk about these in the statement as part of the outlook chapter. I'd like to focus on three of these uncertainties today, which we can frame as three questions. One, how much spare capacity is there? Two, how much and how quickly will wage growth and inflation pick up as spare capacity declines? And three, how resilient will consumption growth be if income growth stays weak? As I already noted, global economic conditions strengthened further over the course of 2017. The three major advanced economies are all growing above the rate of growth of productive capacity, also known as the potential growth rate. This is clear from the large and ongoing declines in the unemployment rate. The question is, how much spare capacity remains in these economies? So far, inflation hasn't picked up much, and neither has wage growth. This might normally suggest that there is still some spare capacity. As this graph shows, though, estimates of the full employment rate of unemployment, the rate of unemployment below which wage growth starts to pick up, in fact suggest that the United States and Japan are already at this point, if not below it. So are some of the individual countries within the euro area. This full employment rate of unemployment, or non-accelerating rate of unemployment, or NIRU, is inherently unobservable. So it has to be estimated. It can be estimated in a number of ways, and there's a deal of uncertainty around these estimates. Often, they come from statistical models which treat every undershoot in the inflation or wage growth outcome as a sign that the NIRU is actually lower than you previously thought. It's therefore useful to think about the economics and the behaviour underlying the existence of a NIRU. It implies that there'll still be some people unemployed at the point that firms have to start bidding up wage offers in order to find suitable staff. This is not so surprising when you consider that the labour market is not homogeneous. There are so many different occupations and types of firms, and these aren't evenly distributed across the economy. So we shouldn't expect labour shortages to appear everywhere at the same time. What happens instead is that they turn up in a few pockets of the labour market, and then a few more, and gradually become more widespread as conditions tighten. How quickly this happens depends partly on where the strong demand for labour is concentrated and how much of the labour force has the applicable skills to perform those roles. So you'd expect wage growth to pick up more and the NIRU to seem higher if the labour market is highly segmented and workers can't easily shift to the areas of strong demand. More flexible labour markets will, all else being equal, have lower NIRUs. Some of the unemployment underlying the NIRU simply reflects people who are between jobs but will find one soon. This is sometimes called frictional unemployment. How quickly people find a job in a tight labour market is partly a technological question. They need to find what vacancies are out there, work out if the job and the firm is a good match for their skills and interests, and then go through a selection process. How long these activities take will help determine how many people are between jobs, even in a tight labour market. The overall rate of job turnover will also matter because that helps determine the flow of people into job search. All of those things can change, for example, because technological change makes job search or selection processes more efficient, or because transaction costs make it more expensive to move for a job. So we shouldn't expect the NIRU to stay at the same level forever. Rather, it can shift gradually in response to structural changes in the labour market and the hiring process, among other things. But because it can't be directly observed, we can only know this from the actual behaviour of wages. Another aspect of spare capacity that isn't always fully appreciated is the scope for extra workers to come directly from outside the labour force or from incumbent workers working more hours rather than from the ranks of the currently unemployed. The more that extra labour demand is met from new entrants or longer hours, the slower the unemployment rate declines. So we can think of broader notions of spare capacity than the NIRU. These would explain why the economy might grow at seemingly above potential rates for longer without hitting capacity constraints. This has been a factor in Australia, where labour force participation has increased sharply over the past year, especially for women. It is now very close to the historical peak it reached in 2010 during the mining investment boom. Meanwhile, the unemployment rate has drifted down, but not as quickly as in some other countries. The increase in participation has been especially marked in Australia, but has not been unique to us. In a number of other industrialised economies, ageing of the population might have been expected to lead to the participation rate trending down. But instead, it's been flat in the euro area and is trending up in Japan, where female participation rates are also increasing noticeably. It has also stabilised recently in the United States, after declining a little faster than what would have been suggested by ageing alone. There also seems to be a cyclical phenomenon that can change the point where economies hit capacity constraints. As we saw in that earlier graph, as economies approach the NIRU, especially if they do so gradually, the estimate of it often seems to decline. This happens on the upside as well. A prolonged period of high unemployment seems to raise estimates of the NIRU. Some of you will know this path dependence phenomenon by the unlovely name of hysteresis. At the current point in the global economic cycle, there is at least some chance that hysteresis will allow some of the economies with tight labour markets to grow a bit faster for a bit longer than might have previously been expected. But eventually, the point where wage growth starts to pick up is reached, and from there, inflation also increases. In Australia, we estimate that there is still some spare capacity in the labour market. Last year, we published a central estimate of the NIRU of around 5%. Since then, we have not seen a reason to change that broad assessment. But we are mindful that as we approach that figure, there's a risk we might find there is more room to come down before wage growth picks up in earnest. Whatever judgment one might make about the extent of spare capacity, it's clear that both here and overseas, it is being absorbed. As it reaches the point of being fully absorbed, wage growth and inflation should increase. The question is, how much and how quickly will they pick up? For the technically minded, this is a question about the slope of the Phillips curve. Here in Australia, wage growth has been quite weak, even allowing for what we estimate to be the extent of spare capacity. Our forecasts are for wage growth to pick up from here, but not immediately, and then only gradually. We're seeing some signs of labour market tightening in the business surveys, which are telling us that suitable labour is becoming increasingly difficult to find. So far, though, the response to that difficulty has not been to pay people more to ensure they stay or to poach them from elsewhere. Instead, we hear that firms are increasingly using the other creative ways to attract and keep staff without paying across-the-board wage rises. These include everything from hiring bonuses to offering extra hours to increasing perks and workplace conditions. Their reasons for doing so stem from the competitive landscape, or at least how it is perceived. Even when facing strong demand and rising cost pressures, firms seem reluctant to raise their prices. This is a theme from our liaison with the business community. They appear to believe that competition is so intense that they would lose too much business if they did so. So they're especially reluctant to grant wage rises because this would increase one of their most important costs. We're seeing this particularly in new enterprise agreements, which lately have tended to involve smaller wage increases than the ones they replaced. These agreements usually last for a couple of years, so this will weigh on overall wage outcomes for a while. If wage growth is to pick up, wage increases for other workers, including in future enterprise agreements or in other wage-setting streams, will need to pick up. Because of these factors, there will probably be some lag between the reports of labour shortages and a generalised pickup in wage growth. We expect, though, that paying more will eventually become part of firms' response. Wage growth, when it comes, will tend to boost labour costs per unit of output. And despite firms' reluctance to raise prices, margins cannot be squeezed forever. Higher costs will therefore boost price inflation over time. A number of important parts of the CPI basket, including many services, have a large labour cost component to their input costs. These are the areas where wage pressures can be expected to show up most clearly as higher inflation. Working against this effect, though, will be the ongoing effects of heightened competition in retail. Australia has seen a marked increase in the number of major retail players. Foreign retailers have entered the local market in recent years and continue to do so. This has also induced the existing players to reduce their costs to stay competitive, for example, by improving inventory management. This has probably been a bit easier for larger or less diversified retailers than for smaller firms. Perhaps this is one of the reasons why growth in retail sales has been much weaker for smaller firms than larger firms. Whether through lower costs, narrower margins, or a combination of both, this competitive dynamic has weighed on prices for consumer durables. And for staples such as food, competition and related pricing changes in pricing strategies, such as everyday low price strategies, have contributed to keeping prices barely changed in net terms for at least 7 years. This is clear from the bottom panel of this graph. Technological change is also often thought to be holding down both wage and price inflation here and overseas. The idea that robots can take your jobs or overseas websites take your customers will naturally dampen anyone's enthusiasm for raising their asking prices. But an important step in the march of the robots is often forgotten. Technological progress requires business investment. First, as with every wave of technology, someone has to design and make the robots. Next, businesses must invest to implement those new technologies and processes. Jobs will still get created in both stages, but they are different ones to the ones replaced. The issue is therefore one of distribution, whether particular countries have the skills needed to become part of that next wave of jobs, and how the income from the ensuing increase in labour productivity is shared between labour and the owners of capital. These are important questions for society, but they don't repeal the laws of supply and demand. The previous two uncertainties were general to both the global economy, especially the major advanced economies, as well as Australia. We're in a different place in terms of the amount of spare capacity that remains, but the overall drivers and questions might not be that different. One aspect of recent developments where Australia's experience differs, though, relates to household income and consumption. As we discussed in the statement, consumption growth in the major advanced economies has been quite robust, supported by strong growth in employment. In Australia, we've also had especially strong employment growth over the past year, more than double the rate of growth in the working age population. But that hasn't translated into strong consumption growth. Household income growth has been weak for a number of years, and that has weighed on consumption growth. Consumption growth hasn't slowed as much as income growth. This is what you'd expect, given that households generally try to smooth their consumption through episodes of income volatility. But there's a question of how long that could continue if income growth stays weak. This clearly has implications for how we think about the risks to our consumption forecasts. The weakness in incomes goes beyond the downward pressure on wage growth that I've already spoken about. Yes, growth in the wage price index, or WPI, has stepped down. But the WPI captures a fixed pool of jobs. It abstracts from compositional change. Average earnings, as measured by the national accounts, have been even weaker than the WPI. That has not occurred because workers shifted between industries. It is also seen within industries. It might be partly driven by the end of the mining investment boom as workers moved out of mining-related work, including in the construction and business services sectors, but it seems to have been broader than that. Our central forecast is that this weakness will end as the drag from the end of the boom dissipates and spare capacity is absorbed, so that average earnings growth recovers. There is no guarantee of this, though, and therein lies the risk. The living cost pressures that many households feel have therefore been an income story, not a price inflation story. Although utilities prices did increase significantly in some states in recent quarters, much of households' regular spending has seen relatively little in the way of price increases for a number of years. Weak income growth can run below consumption growth for time, but not forever. If households start to see this weakness in income growth as permanent, they're likely to change their spending patterns in response. We might be seeing this in the details of the consumption figures. Growth in spending on discretionary items like travel and eating out has slowed, while growth in spending on essentials has held up. Continued weak income growth presents a particular risk to the consumption outlook in the context of high household indebtedness. Households do not just wake up one day and collectively decide to pay down their debt. But if incomes turn out weaker than they expect, or some other adverse news should arise, the households carrying the most debt might feel they have to rein in their spending quite a bit. The past and present are never completely clear. The future is even less so. The three questions I discussed today are not the only ones relevant to the current outlook. They are central, though, and in many ways, they're connected. After a long period of spare capacity and low inflation, the global economy is in an upswing phase. How that upswing plays out, both here and overseas, is a focus of our work. And as we do that work, we're mindful of the structural and other factors that can make a difference to economic behaviour. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Casey. A great speech there, and I liked your insights that orthodox economic outcomes will win in the end. I love that assumption because there's some debate around that at the moment. So Lucy's agreed to take some questions from the floor. So who's got some questions? Paul?
Lucy, it's Paul Box from HSBC. The chart you put up on the breakdown of wages across the various industries, that one with AENA with the fall in wages growth, in wages growth of almost minus 4%, strikes me as quite stunning. When I read the whole statement last week, I thought that was the one bit that just didn't seem like it fit with everything else, because firstly, it doesn't line up particularly well with the wage price index. Secondly, if you look at what's going on in terms of output in the economy, you've got a pickup going on in the goods sectors. And thirdly, if you think about the various anecdotes about the pockets of wage pressure, they're coming from areas associated with construction, infrastructure investment, residential construction. These are sort of goods-related areas. So I just wonder how you reconcile the left panel's blue line with the wage price index and the rest of the things we know about that sector.
It's a very good point, Paul. Thank you for the question. And you're right. I mean, one of the ways to reconcile these things is, well, you know, the data might just be misleading. Remembering, of course, that we're only up to the September quarter on these data, and you know, the reports of the pockets and the increasingly larger pockets has really been in the last couple of months. It's not, you might not have seen it yet in a year-end into September quarter number. We find that surprising. I mean, it's clear that the income numbers are saying what they're saying, and they're coming from, you know, tax data and all, you know, payrolls data. So it's not completely made up. I mean, allocating that between industries may have some error, but you know, the ABS does the best it can in getting the eyesight of the accounts right, and this is really coming from average earnings per hour. It is quite stark, and it may be that it's, you know, these are more volatile than the WPI and it just bounces back. But we're, you know, we also saw in all of these three industries there were periods where there was, you know, a big gap between national accounts measures of earnings and the WPI. And typically what happens is the national accounts measure comes back to closer to where the WPI is over time. So you have compositional shifts that don't go on forever. And that sort of understanding is underlying our forecasts of, you know, incomes coming back, which is really important for consumption growth. But you're right, it just hasn't happened yet. And, you know, maybe the answer is data revisions, but, you know, we're not in the business of forecasting data revisions. Hi, Rory.
Hi,
Lisa.
Thanks for your talk. Rory Robertson, Westpac. Lizzie, on your final chart, where you've got a split of household consumption into essentials and discretionary.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could tell us what's in essential and whether the sort of split is actually, whether they are actually essentials or whether there's not a ton of discretionary stuff in there as well.
Well, I think, you know, what's one person's essential is another person's discretionary, but I haven't got the list of exactly how this is split up. And you know, we can come back to you with the exact list.
I'm
but
I'm thinking that often yeah. It's got things like, you know, communications in it, it's got some health in it, it's got some education in it.
Yeah.
It's got sort of utilities like electricity. They're deemed essentials, but
it's
when
essential
I was growing up, my mother turned off the hot water system.
Yeah.
So then I walk around my house and there would be a dozen little lights gleaming where electricity is basically being used and being paid for.
Yeah.
So, and communication, like how much internet do you need, how much mobile phone do you need? So I've seen this recently popping up, but one of the things out there is that sort of Australians are doing it so tough, and yet Australian society has never been more affluent. And the things that are deemed essential today often are things that basically you turn the light, turn the switch, and there's no cost anymore. So, that's in my speech, but I'm just interested. This is sort of coming into the analysis.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much of the essentials are actually essentials when things like private education and, you know, the need for sort of new needs and interests and all this other stuff, a lot of it is discretionary, signed up as essential.
I think someone who's in serious pain with their knees and hips would regard relief of that pain as being pretty essential. And healthcare is an essential. But, I mean, I take your point, and, you know, how you split this up, you know, is at some level arbitrary. And so some of the kind of categories, if you think about, I mean, if you think about how, you know, mortgage affordability, mortgage serviceability is established by lenders, they think about, well, what's your spending pattern? What's a typical spending pattern for someone of your income and of your family structure? And they think about, well, if you have a average spending on essentials and slightly below average spending on discretionary, and that's how they think about what a typical spending pattern is. That's how serviceability tests work. So, yeah, yes, you can argue about, you know, whether, you know, certain things should be in there. And, you know, okay, I don't know, you know, maybe you switched the light off, but did you switch to LED? You know, but I think, you know, one of the things that is happening, and we will be picking up more and more, particularly as the CPI is going to annual reweighting, is we will pick up more and more of the spending switches that people are making, not only between categories of spending, but within categories of spending and across retailers. And of course, as I mentioned with, you know, the retail competition, part of what is going on is that, you know, looking at the same product in the same store, that price might be rising, but what people are actually spending is less because they switch to a cheaper retailer. Or they're shopping on, you know, on sale for the firms that still have sales rather than other pricing strategies. So, you know, I agree that, you know, what's truly essential, you know, you'll find out in dire straits. And I think that is one of the considerations we think about when we think about, well, if something in terms of the real tail risks to consumption, if something bad happens to the incomes of a segment of the population who are indebtedness, who have high indebtedness, if we think about, you know, what might happen to their consumption? Well, yeah, they could start changing their consumption patterns quite drastically. And I think this is a good way of showing that there are early signs of people making those choices. You know, can we go back to bread and dripping and still live? Yes, we can. how much would it take to make people do that? Well, it would have to be pretty dire.
Hi, Swati from Reuters. In the song, you inserted a new line about inflation reaching the midpoint of the 2-3% band. I think the understanding earlier was that inflation would reach anywhere between the band, like whether it's a floor or 2.25. But is it that 2.5 is now more important than anywhere, being anywhere in the band?
I think the way I would characterise it is that we want, you know, we had extended the forecast period another two quarters in the most recent statement, and the trajectory of the inflation forecast is up, so you get closer to that point. So we were describing where the forecast gets to with the longer period. I don't want to, you know, characterise that as any change in view. I wouldn't regard it as a change in how we think about the target and what it is that we, the bank has been asked to achieve.
Peter?
Behind here. Peter Joy at NAB. I was just trying to work out, you know, the NAIRU estimate that you mentioned. I did read that article last year. How do we think about the underemployment rate, which we know has been quite high, those who have a job but might want to work more hours, in that concept of the NAIRU?
It's, I mean, firstly, with the NAIRU estimates, there are huge error bands on that. So, you know, it's very difficult to be too precise about that estimate. We did a lot of work about a year ago thinking about underemployment because it wasn't coming down as quickly as you might have expected given what was happening to unemployment. But more recently, they've come back again. In fact, that was in this graph, wasn't it? So the underutilisation rate, the purple line in this graph, you know, they're not moving any differently at the moment, so you can't kind of statistically disentangle a separate effect very easily. But it's certainly something we watch, and it's one of the reasons why we think in the event of an increase in labour demand, not all of that gets absorbed as formerly unemployed workers becoming employed. Some of it is people working more hours who want more hours.
Just last one, thanks.
Sorry, two-parter, if you don't mind. Is the role of the RBA cash rate changing with regard to relevance to the broader economy, you know, with the actual lending rate to household and business coming through? And then secondly, given the high level of household indebtedness, would the RBA ever consider a rate increment of less than 25 basis points?
Okay. It's interesting. So in answer to your first question about whether the role of the cash rate in influencing other rates in the market has changed, I gave my first public speech as an RBA official in 2009. And at the time, there was a lot of controversy about the fact that the banks were moving their mortgage rates differently from the cash rate. And it's a long time ago now, but if I recall, I had some line about there being no law in either, you know, statutory law or economic law that said that those two things had to move perfectly together. And I stand by that statement from 2009. On the second point about with high household indebtedness, would we consider a different increment? Look, I think, you know, the imprecision of economic data, the imprecision of what we know about the world, you know, there are certainly central banks that use different increments, but I haven't heard that conversation in this building. I think, you know, you can try and be too cute and too overly precise about these things. Economic measurement is hard. There's a lot of imprecision. Pretending that you know, I mean, certainly, yeah, there are central banks who've gone below zero who are then doing sort of increments of 0.1. But at the levels that we're at, it just hasn't set, you know, it hasn't been an imperative so far.
I was thinking more about, I guess, sentiment rather than actual quantitative numbers in terms of, you know, what, like a 25 basis point hike off 150, obviously, a lot of, like, media would have, you know, go to town on that and impact.
Yeah, we're conscious of the fact that, you know, at low interest rates, you know, a 25 basis point move matters more for the percentage change in the repayment than it does when interest rates are higher. That's actually, Paul Bloxham wrote a note about that when he was a new graduate here about 15 years ago. So, yeah, that's something we're aware of.
All right. Thank you, Lucy. Please join me in thanking Lucy for her speech.